Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. I am Ari Markinson. I am a partner and the co-chair of the Healthcare and Life Sciences Practice at Winston & Strawn. We are here today to talk a little bit about some regulatory diligence considerations and healthcare services transactions. This is our first webinar in a series of webinars that we have running out right now through about 6-7 months, all that relate to both healthcare and M&A topics within the healthcare and life sciences industry. We will be adding to the calendar as we go on, and you can see the calendar itself actually in the original invitation you got. It's on the web, on our website. It's also in the slides today towards the end. Would love to have you join us as often as you can for any of these presentations. Joining me today is Cynthia Suarez, one of our wonderful associates in New York, who is on in our healthcare and corporate group. She and I will be presenting to you throughout the hour. Oh, and around the middle of the presentation, I'll be, to the extent that you need continuing legal education credit for the presentation, I'll put up a slide and give you the code that you need for getting that credit. Okay, let's get started. Let's do a little bit of level setting. So a little bit of level setting in terms of how we're looking at what healthcare services are. Our group at Winston is a healthcare and life sciences group. There's, as you can imagine, within that broad definition of an industry, there's lots of different sub-industries, sub-portions of what you think of as healthcare and life sciences. But when we're talking about healthcare services, we really are defining it in a very specific way. And what we're doing is we're looking at those types of healthcare businesses that are providing professional clinical healthcare services to patients, as well as brick-and-mortar inpatient-outpatient healthcare providers and businesses that provide sort of ancillary healthcare services and supplies. It's more retail healthcare than what you think of as more on the life sciences side or on the pharmaceutical medical device manufacturer side. In fact, our next session in this series, we'll be talking about similar sort of healthcare regulatory diligence issues specific to sort of the pharma device and life sciences space. Okay. Now, as an overview of the presentation of the webinar today, I want to do, again, a little bit of level setting to recognize that our intent is to some extent take you back to the beginning and really give you a good framework for thinking about things that you have to look at, that you have to consider in healthcare services M&A. Now, you may say to yourself, I get all this stuff, you know, I know it. But what's important about the webinar is that we're hoping that you basically take this webinar, turn it into a cheat sheet, a to-do list, right? That this, frankly, you could take the major items that we talk through in this webinar, the titles of each of the slides and the basic items within the slides, and you can turn them into a kind of to-do list for any new transaction that you're turning in, you know, that you're looking at and saying, okay, have we, you know, check off the boxes? Have we looked at this issue? Have we asked those questions? That's really what we're intending to do with this particular webinar today, is to give you that framework for making sure that on a high level, you've covered all the material issues you should be covering in doing a transaction like this, particularly from a healthcare regulatory perspective. So we're framing out potential material risks in these kinds of transactions. We're framing out what kind of diligence relating to those risks you should be doing. And we're framing out, and on a very broad basis, just the reps and warranties that go along with those types of risks. Now, with that said, Cynthia, why don't I hand it off to you to just talk about the specific categories of risks?
Sure. Thanks, Ari. Sorry, as Ari mentioned, there's a couple of broad risks, which we've broken up into five kind of main categories that we could use for now as a guidepost. So we have government reimbursement issues, fraud and abuse, licensure, excluded parties, and privacy, as they all relate to healthcare issues. And then we'll talk about the, as Ari mentioned, the diligence and reps and warranties related to each one of these risks.
So you'll see as we move along, we're essentially connecting those material risks to each of the considerations, right? So we'll be going through each of those risks and then going through each of those material considerations as we move forward with our webinar. Okay, let's get going. Government reimbursement. So most, if not all, healthcare services providers, suppliers, take some form of government reimbursement. Now, again, granted, some don't, but many, many, many do. And in certain types of services, like healthcare systems, for example, healthcare systems can't exist without Medicare and Medicaid. It's just they just can't. That may be different for certain types of durable medical equipment suppliers that supply crutches and walkers and those kinds of things and are able to just do commercial business, for example. However, you do expect to see some level of Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement, whether it be straight traditional fee-for-service Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement, or some managed care Medicare or Medicaid reimbursement that's flowing to those providers and suppliers. Now, in getting that reimbursement, claims are being submitted, and or there's some type of at-risk structure or value-based payment structure, whereby those providers or suppliers are getting paid through government programs for the services or supplies they're being provided. Some of the material risks that exist in being a provider in those programs, right, are not doing things properly, right, not following the government's rules when it comes to participating in those programs. And so the providers and suppliers can be subject to take-backs, recoupments, which is a lovely word in the healthcare provider and supplier world that we hear constantly, right? A recoupment of dollars, an allegation of an overpayment. Often you have an allegation of an overpayment, right? We, the government, paid you too much, and now we want to recoup it from you. We want our money back. And you can have, depending on the severity of the issue, civil penalties, right? The demand for civil penalties if they believe that the provider essentially did something inappropriate. You also have civil penalties associated with other kinds of, and we'll get a little bit deeper into this as we go into some of the fraud and abuse issues, but civil penalties associated with other kinds of so-called, for lack of a better term, inappropriate use of government reimbursement programs, that don't just relate to necessarily to claims, but might relate to relationships between providers and suppliers and those kinds of things. Cynthia, why don't you talk a little bit about the kinds of things that you'd want to look at in looking at these issues?
Sure. So in conducting due diligence related to government reimbursement, you kind of want to try to get a sense of whether there are existing issues in the target company's reimbursement practices, and so you can assess whether that poses any minor or significant liabilities going forward. So in order to assess these risks, at the very least, you want to take a look at any documents that relate to investigations, audits, site visits, or inquiries by government agencies and contractors that the target company has been the subject of. You want to look at any reimbursement-related corrective action plans that may have been imposed on the company or that they implemented of their own accord. You also want to take a look at documents that relate to any unpaid civil monetary or administrative penalties and civil settlements to see what liabilities exist there financially. And you also want to look at whether the target company has made any kind of self-disclosures or voluntary disclosures to a government body that relates to their documentation when it comes to reimbursement. And then lastly, we also have documents that relate to any kind of internal or third-party audit reports on the company's billing and coding practices.
Just a quick comment about the last point. Very often now in sale processes, you're seeing that the seller is doing kind of pre-sale diligence on themselves, where they're getting some type of hopefully a reputable consultant to do, for example, billing coding diligence and do a report. And so you do want to see that. I mean, obviously, I don't suggest that you look at it, that you rely solely on that. But you certainly want to get a handle on that and see it and get a sense of what someone on a pre-sale basis had to say about the company's billing and coding practices. Okay. So irrespective of the looking at those documents and information relating to all those issues with respect to particularly government reimbursement issues, you're still going to build into any transaction document, whether it be a loan, a credit agreement or an MA, equity purchase agreement or something like that, you're still going to want to build in reps and warranties where the seller / borrower, depending on what you're looking, the way of looking at this, right, that broadly addresses very important categories, right, compliance with healthcare laws. And often you will see, by the way, that it is not just this sort of basic two-liner that says we comply with all healthcare laws. Usually there's an expectation that there's going to be a couple of pages, frankly, of specific healthcare law compliance representations and warranties. And frankly, the reason for that is that you want to be sure that the seller and or the borrower is really paying attention to what you're asking them to rep to. And the only way to do that is by being very specific about certain issues without just saying sort of, material compliance with all healthcare laws. It's too easy for somebody to sort of say, oh, yeah, okay, that's okay, I'll sign up to that. And so you really are going to end up with very specific, I haven't bribed anybody under the anti-kickback statute. I haven't engaged in any self-referral activity with physicians. I haven't violated any corporate practice of medicine prohibitions. I've filed all my claims appropriately. I haven't lost a license or had a license suspended. All those types of issues. You're going to have reps and warranties that relate to the fact that I haven't had any material overpayment obligations or any overpayment demands made upon me. I'm not subject to any kind of significant civil or criminal enforcement matter. I'm saying that broadly, but the rep itself would get pretty specific into the types of matters. I have no subpoenas or other touches from government regulatory agencies with respect to healthcare regulatory matters. And then you might also have very, very broad reps that just talk about certain types of inappropriate or illegal conduct in general. So rather than saying I haven't engaged in, anti-kickback behavior specifically under the federal anti-kickback statute, you may have a rep that basically says I haven't engaged in kickbacks that may violate any kind of federal or state law, right? And so you generally see, particularly in this area, very broad, very significant, very detailed representations and warranties that cover a whole host of issues. And the purpose, frankly, is that there's a little bit of a diligence purpose to it. Beyond all the diligence that you already did, it's really to ensure that the buyer, that the seller and or borrower, right, have really focused on the types of things that you might be concerned with as a lender or a buyer. Okay. Our CLE code. So anyone who needs CLE out of this presentation, your code is 10212. Again, it's 10212. We will re-give you that code at another point in the presentation, but as of now, there it is. Okay, let's move on to our next point. So probably one of the largest areas of material risk sort of plays off of the last one in the sense that government reimbursement is certainly a material risk, but participation in government programs, right, carries with it very significant compliance obligations under several fraud and abuse laws, federal fraud and abuse laws. There are certainly state corollaries, but I'll just stick with the federal ones. And the non-compliance under these laws carries very, very significant penalties. And as a result, a large portion of any sort of, you know, healthcare regulatory diligence project with respect to a healthcare service provider or supplier is looking at these kinds of issues, looking at federal anti-kickback issues, looking at federal self-referral issues to the extent they apply, and looking at a type of False Claims Act type issues. Before we jump into the diligence request, just give a quick understanding of each of these statutes, right? The federal anti-kickback statute essentially says on a very high level, person A cannot give something of value to person B in exchange for person B referring federal healthcare program business to person A. So you can't get a kickback in exchange for getting access to, and I'm being very, very, very high level, Medicare and Medicaid business. The physician self-referral law, the Stark law, is similar but different, and you'll recognize why I'm saying that. It is federal anti-kickback is a federal criminal law. It is a felony to violate the law. Both parties to the transaction violate the law and are guilty of a felony. The federal physician self-referral law, the Stark law, is a civil law. And what it essentially does is it basically says that physicians who have financial relationships, whether it be ownership or compensation, with entities to which they refer patients to, cannot refer those patients to. And the relationships, by the way, can also be familial relationships in the sense that if a physician or their immediate family member has that compensation or ownership relationship, the physician can't make a referral. There are all sorts of exceptions. I don't want to go into all of them, but that's the basic structure of the statute. And what's important about that law is that it's a strict liability law. If A plus B equals C, you've violated the law unless you meet an exception. Whereas anti-kickback statute is intent-based. There are safe harbors to it, but essentially the government's got to prove its case, got to prove intent. The Stark law is just a pure calculation. And if you didn't meet an exception, you violated the law. And the basic penalty for violating the law is that the services that were referred, the service provider of those referred services has to basically pay the money back to the government. There's other penalties I don't want to go into. I don't want to get too deep into it, but that's the basics of the Stark law, right? The Criminal and Civil False Claims Act are essentially similar in nature, different in degree, in the sense that one's criminal, one's civil. But basically, you can't rip off the government with false claims, right? You cannot submit false claims to the government for healthcare services in their healthcare programs. Those false claims can take all different kinds of structures and so forth. And I don't want to get, again, too deep into it, but just to say, you know, look, it's very simple to say that a false claim is essentially, you know, submitting a claim for a patient you never saw. Little bit different to say that a false claim is you submitting claims for patients that you did see, but you forgot to, or willfully didn't, right, sign their charts. So there's all different variations about whether or not something could or couldn't be a false claim. But the False Claims Act statutes are basically statutes that say you submitted, you know, a claim to the government that was false, and all sorts of interpretations of what that is. Again, I don't want to get into it. I'm just trying to give a real, real basic overview of what these issues are. Now, given that, let's move on to kind of Cynthia talking a little bit about diligence requests for these issues.
Thanks. So with the fraud and abuse issues, you know, there's definitely some significant potential liabilities there. So in conducting diligence, a lot of what you're focusing on is the company's relationships. So for example, you would want to look at any contracts that are between the target company and other healthcare businesses or vendors and get a sense of the financial relationship that exists there. There might be certain arrangements that the target feels fits into the anti-kickback statute safe harbor or a Stark Law exception. If that's the case, you would want to, you know, ask whether or not there was any kind of third party or attorney analyzing the arrangement to see if there's documentation on how that termination was reached. You'd also want to look at the business relationships between the target and physicians and other healthcare professionals, as well as with individuals and entities that are in a position to refer business that's paid for by governmental programs, and make sure that those arrangements don't run afoul of any of the fraud and abuse statutes. Similarly, there are certain statutory restrictions on how marketing activities can be conducted, so you want to review the target's marketing activities and make sure that there's nothing untoward there. And finally, you'd also want to look at any kind of bonus and compensation plans to see that there's no financial risk there.
Just as a quick comment, it is simple enough to violate the anti-kickback statute by a physician calling up another physician and saying, if you send me patient A, I'm going to send you over a bottle of wine. Is somebody going to prosecute that? That's a whole other story. But that situation, that hypothetical, could violate the anti-kickback statute. Now, that's because the way the statute is structured, it's so broad. And so you are looking for business relationships and other kinds of things in looking at these documents to see if there's something that seems like it could present anti-kickback risk. My hypothetical was sort of silly, right? And it was easy. But if a hospital system provides a physician office space at significant below market rent, okay, essentially to incentivize that physician to refer all of his or her patients to the hospital, that's a potential anti-kickback issue, and it's a potential Stark issue, okay? And so you can see that better, and that's the kinds of things that you really are going to be taking a look at in pulling these documents and seeing if there are issues that exist there. On reps and warranties, you'd have very specific reps and warranties relating to specific compliance with the anti-kickback statute, the Stark self-referral law, the absence of any kind of civil settlements or CMPs relating to those laws, the absence of any kind of threatened or current civil criminal litigation relating specifically to fraud and abuse, all of those kinds of issues covering these kinds of risks. Let's talk a little bit about licensure. Many, not all, but many healthcare services providers and suppliers are required to have some type of license, permit, certification, something. Sometimes it's even an exemption to licensure to do what they do, right? It could be local, it could be state, it could be federal. Local, it could literally be in, you know, having a permit to run the kitchen in the assisted living facility. On a state level, it could be the license to run your home health agency. On a federal level, it could be your DEA registration number. It just depends. but you can pretty much assume, and I've said this 1,000 times in my career, if not more, you can pretty much assume that if we're talking about healthcare businesses, that somebody's got a license, a certification, an exemption, essentially a permit as a general rule, right? And in looking at transactions, you always want to understand what permits exist and what, if anything, needs to be done with respect to those permits as a result of a possible transaction. And you also certainly want to look at the target's historic compliance under those permits. Cynthia, why don't you talk a little bit about diligence requests?
Sure, thanks. So as Ari mentioned, kind of as a baseline, you want to start with looking at all of the current healthcare-related permits, licenses, certifications, accreditations, et cetera, that the target company has in relation to its business. And then from there, you can kind of look into, you know, as far as its history, you want to request documents that relate to any kind of investigation, audit, survey, site visits, inquiries that have been made by government agency or contractor that relates to those licenses, permits, et cetera, that are held. If there had been any issues, you know, in the past, then there might be some type of corrective action plan that the target company took upon itself or was told to take by a government agency. So you want to see documentation related to that as well. If there's any evidence of unpaid civil monetary penalties, administrative penalties, civil settlements, and finally, you'd want to look at any kind of documentation that relates to an instance where the license might have been suspended or terminated or revoked, and kind of get a sense of what was behind that, as well as any instance where there was refusal to approve a license.
One thing that I would add in talking about licensure is that often, while you're certainly looking to make sure historically that the target has, or the potential borrower, right, has complied with their licensure requirements and that there's no issues with that, you just want to understand that they have the proper licenses in place and all those kinds of things, often both parties also treat as a diligence item the permit, the licensure transfer process, right? That essentially, and I have this come across, and Cynthia does too, across our desks every day where we're on a transaction and somebody says, you know, one of the more corporate folks involved in transactions says, hey, how long is it going to take to transfer that license? You know, the common term, right, is CHOW, change of ownership. It's the CHOW is that acronym for change of ownership. And it's sort of, you know, how long is it going to take for you to process the CHOW with respect to this transaction? Boy, I wish that was a really easy answer off the top of your head to give in any state with respect to any kind of license or permit. It usually is something that needs to be researched. But however, it's something that does affect transaction timing. It can affect who can own. So as an example, in certain states, a certain type of license may only be allowed to be owned, you know, by a certain type of entity or in a certain type of ownership chain or only by certain individuals who have gotten fingerprinted and don't have any, you know, skeletons in their closet, no felony convictions and those kinds of things. And particularly where you have private investment, you know, private equity investment in certain types of healthcare services and supplies, and also for lenders who are, you know, unfortunately in workouts or in other kinds of situations where they may be stepping into the equity of an entity, there's lots of considerations around, you know, do I want that license in my name or do I want disclosure of up the chain ownership going all the way up the chain? Right now, as an example, in many states, particularly on the Medicare and Medicaid provider side, and certainly with respect to licensure in many states, this is a broad sort of golden rule that the agency wants ownership disclosure. Forget all the other issues involved, but the agency wants ownership disclosure going up the chain from the licensed entity or the entity that holds the provider number of anyone or any entity, right, that owns 5% or more of the entity below it. That can get funky in private equity ownership structures and just deciding on who, you know, where does that stop and why, and it can get funky, particularly when you get a situation where a bank or alternative debt provider or equity provider, you know, wants to step into their shoes in a workout situation, and how do they handle disclosing that information? And so it's something that is often looked at as part of diligence, is sort of just what's the license transfer process that's involved in this transaction, so that everybody from, you know, buyer, seller, and lender are on the same page about the timing of all of that and the requirements for all of it. Okay. So when you look at the reps and warranties associated with licensure, you're always going to have one rep that basically says the seller has all the licenses they're required to have, right? You're going to have a rep, it may be included in the same rep, that says that essentially that none of the licenses they have been subject to suspension or revocation or have been terminated, and that the seller essentially isn't aware of any action to suspend, revoke, or terminate any of their required licenses. It's often a negotiated point of, right, written notice or no notice or any notice, essentially, you know, where do the parties get to in terms of what they know about the potential for these kinds of actions? And what's important about sometimes negotiating that those issues is that, as a perfect example, a federal certification survey for the Medicare program or a state certification survey for the Medicaid program. The way federal law works in either of those situations, and federal law covers both those situations because, as I hope everyone on the webinar knows, is that the feds pay for, essentially, I'm making this up, but because it's different now, but at one point in time, essentially, feds covered half of state share of Medicaid, and so the feds have a bunch of rules around the Medicaid program. Now, essentially, the Fed rules with respect to surveys, how the feds call them, right, with respect to inspections for certification, is that at some point in time, if deficiencies are found, so if the inspectors come in and find something with respect to the provider or supplier that they find is deficient from the regulations, the provider or supplier is cited with a deficiency. And the way the process works is that the provider or supplier is at some point required to file what's called a plan of correction. And to the satisfaction of the state that does these inspections, both on behalf of Medicaid and Medicare, essentially file a plan of correction that hopefully to the satisfaction of the state gets signed off on. Now, the fact is, the way the law works is that if you either don't file that plan of correction, and or it's not accepted by a date that, by the way, it's like months and months and months out, but there is a date, there is an end date, you will be automatically thrown out of the program, whether it be Medicare or Medicaid, by law, not by anybody's choice. And so the question becomes, right, and negotiation over this language sometimes becomes that, well, look, we have this open survey, right? But so technically, that open survey is an action that could result in a termination of, you know, our license or provider number or whatever, but nobody expects that to happen. And you end up negotiating over this, is it just a item that gets scheduled? You know, do you have language around it? How do you deal with the fact that, yes, technically, you know, you can't, a seller could not, or a borrower could not, accept that rep as written without some sort of exception relating to that matter that, yes, if it went down the wrong road, could in fact result in a termination. And there are things like that that come up often in terms of many of the different types of reps and warranties that you, as a buyer, as a lender, want to get as clean as you can. Let's move on to talking about excluded parties. I have written a ton on this issue over many years of my career, simply because I've always really been surprised by clients that get themselves tripped up by this issue. It is a massive low-hanging fruit issue for the government. And an extremely easy issue for a provider or supplier to steer clear of. So what the heck is an excluded party? The federal government, both in the Medicare and Medicaid programs, as well as in its federal contracting process in general. So if you sell widgets to the Department of Energy, you can still be excluded. And I'll explain that in a bit. However, essentially what it means to be an excluded party is the government, is the United States federal government, is saying that it cannot do any business with you. And what's important about that is that it cannot do any business with you through intermediaries. And so, take this example. John Smith owns Loving Home Care Agency. John Smith gets himself into a heck of a lot of trouble with Loving Home Care Agency. He settles with the government. As part of his settlement with the government, he is forced to agree to an exclusion for 5 years from Medicare and Medicaid. So he is formally excluded. Okay. Now, by the way, there is a reinstatement process that I'm not going to go into, but just to explain it. So John Smith is excluded. He has he is also a nurse. And so to be sure that he can be gainfully employed, he decides to go to Caring Home Care Agency that he doesn't own down the street and say, "Hey, Mama, hey, I'm a nurse. I'm very familiar with home care. Can you hire me just as a nurse?" Caring Home Care does not bother to check the list of people excluded from Medicare and Medicaid, and they hire John Smith as a nurse. And John Smith is getting 3 years of salary from Caring Home Care before somebody says, "Did we ever check him?" And they check him and they find out that he's been excluded. What that ends up doing is that, unfortunately, Caring Home Care now has a huge problem with the federal government. Or Medicaid, depending on, you know, depending on who we provided services to. But they essentially have to self-disclose that they have been employing a person who's been excluded from Medicare and Medicaid for that period of time, and it's a long period of time. And it becomes a very, very significant negotiation with the government, usually ends up in a nasty settlement over the employment of somebody who's been excluded from Medicare and Medicaid or from federal healthcare programs. Now, what could Caring have done to avoid that? The most simplest of things. They could have essentially gone on to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, OIG website, its exclusion website, and just before they hired John Smith, just thrown in his name and his Social Security and just checked him out and made sure that he was not excluded. They also, just to be sure, would go to the U.S. General Services Administration website and make sure that he wasn't excluded there. It's the simplest thing to do. It's a web search. Most providers and suppliers do, in fact, use services to do this for them regularly on their employees. So, by the way, recognize, obviously, that you could hire somebody and they're not excluded, but then 2 months later, because of some other activities that are involved, and they are excluded. And so you do want to check on a periodic basis. But it's low-hanging fruit. The government very often does come around and say, we check your employee list, and we found this guy or gal who was excluded. How come you didn't know? It's just so easy for the government to, and it's a black and white situation. They either are or aren't excluded. And so it's just something that you'd expect, absolutely expect, providers and suppliers to be on top of and make sure that they're not running afoul of. So how do you do that? Why don't you talk quickly about that, Cynthia?
Mm-hmm. Right. So basically you want to see if the target company has a process to screen for excluded parties. So while a company might say, like, oh, we run a typical background check on potential employees, an excluded party search might not necessarily be part of a standard background check. So whether the company is doing the checks themselves or they hired a third party, you want to ask and see if part of that background check process is to specifically screen for excluded parties. And continuing with that, to see if there is a process to do periodic checks, because as already mentioned, even if they weren't excluded when they first started, things can happen down the line and perhaps they did end up on that list. So you want to know that the company is aware of that and checks on that. And then related to that, you'd want to see if there had been any kind of past exposure to an excluded party, and if there was, how the company handled that and what steps they took to fix that.
Yeah, I think just to add quickly to that, you know, the last thing you want to hear on that last piece is that, oh, we just fired the person. Because you've got, I mean, if you were hiring an excluded party and that excluded party was involved in services that were paid for by Medicare and Medicaid, or by any federal health care program for that matter, you firing them doesn't resolve the issue with the government. There's a bigger issue there that has to be resolved. And so you do want to ask them about how they, if they found somebody, how they handle it. Reps and warranties related to excluded parties are pretty easy. You want to make sure that they haven't hired any excluded party, but it usually goes even broader than that. You usually include a rep that says that no officer, director, essentially that no one associated with the company, particularly at an ownership or D&O level, right, has ever been excluded. And certainly that they haven't, you know, hired any excluded folks. Or in some cases, engage, you know, they have no knowledge of ever sort of contracting with anybody who's excluded. Usually you provide knowledge with respect to that because it's just hard necessarily for parties to always be able to rep to who their contractors, whether or not their contractors are excluded. And then you want them to rep to the fact that they're periodically checking for exclusion. Okay. Let's move on to talk a little bit about healthcare privacy issues. We will be doing actually within this webinar series at some point. We don't have it scheduled as of yet, but at some point we'll be doing a very specific both HIPAA and high-tech privacy types issues, but a broader look at privacy issues for healthcare providers and suppliers. As I said, within the webinar series, we haven't yet figured out when, but we'll certainly let you know. But right now, we just want to broadly talk about the kinds of issues that come up and diligence on those kinds of issues. So I'm going to assume that, but I'll talk about it. I'm going to assume that everybody within the webinar knows that since 1996 now, we have a national law, HIPAA, that applies to the privacy of certain types of healthcare information. Personal health information is how it's referred to, PHI, in the law. It applies to what's called covered entities. Covered entities broadly under the law are essentially providers, suppliers, healthcare clearinghouses, and payers. It also applies to what's called business associates. And those business associates are essentially folks that are doing certain types of business functions for covered entities. Violations of the law can result in both civil and criminal liability, depending on the severity of the issues. When the law was originally passed in 1996, you would go to information sessions that the Office of Civil Rights, which is the responsible agency for the Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Civil Rights, the responsible agency for enforcing the law, you'd go to their information sessions and they'd say, we're the kindler, gentler office of the of DHHS, and you know, now that it's a new law and it's new for everybody, we just want to educate everyone and make sure that everybody understands what their obligations are and how the law works. And now we are, you know, almost, if not more, 20 years plus past when the law was enacted, and they're no longer kindler and gentler in terms of enforcement. The agency, you probably see major enforcement litigation cases in the sort of healthcare press, for lack of a better term, on a daily basis. Breaches, breach notifications, very significant issues about privacy in the popular press on a daily basis. And it's become a very, very significant issue. And interestingly, right, more significant as we move more information into technology, more data into our technology, we end up with more obligation to comply with the law, and also, you know, unfortunately, you know, more possibility of potential concerns of breaches and those kinds of things. With all of that said, just quickly before I jump to let Cynthia talk, the law has both privacy requirements, so policies and procedures relating to how the privacy of information is supposed to be kept, right? There's something called the privacy rule, that is regulations that are as a result of the statute, govern how an organization that's a covered entity has to have policies and procedures for privacy, and all those kinds of things, and a privacy officer. And then there are security rules. So there are rules that govern how information is supposed to be kept secure and how an organization is supposed to have a security officer responsible for those things. Depending on the organization, privacy and security officers may be one and the same, maybe two different people. It just depends. With that said, why don't I now jump to Cynthia to talk a little bit about developing our diligence requests.
Thanks. So with privacy issues and especially the increased focus the last couple of years, you're not only looking at the financial implications of those risks, but also potential reputational implications. So when conducting your diligence, some of the things that you want to look at is, one, if there's what are the HIPAA compliance policies and procedures that the target company has in place covering at least the previous 3 years. And, you know, this would also include any HIPAA training materials and information on how employees and personnel receive HIPAA training. So you want to make sure that just because they have the policies written down, they're also being followed through. And then you also want to see with copies of BAAs, which are business associate agreements, basically covered entities that have to share PHI with the business associate should have a written BAA in place that requires that third party to comply with HIPAA requirements. So you want to see copies of those. And then you also want to look at any documentation that relates to HIPAA compliance tracking and assessment within the company, any documentation if there had been security breaches or incidents, documentation of that, as well as what the follow-up response was to address the breach or incidents, and if the company had to make any kind of disclosure to third parties that were affected by it. And then you would also want to see any complaints or allegations of a privacy or security breach that the company might have received from third parties.
So just to quickly add to that as well, one of the things that we're seeing a ton of now and everybody's seeing is that the enforcement agency is essentially, if you've been subject to a breach, you've had an issue, the first thing the enforcement agency is essentially asking often is not, okay, tell us what happened. It's tell us how you've complied with the law such that this should not have happened. And what I mean by that is that the enforcement agency is essentially saying, show us that you had done a security assessment. Show us that you have policies and procedures in place. And that's really catching up, you know, it's really catching up folks who can't prove, right, that they used appropriate either internal or external resources to do security assessments, or that they have a security officer or a privacy officer. The law, as I said earlier, it's been around since 1996. And the enforcement agency is beyond past somebody telling them, you know, I didn't know I had to do X, Y, and Z. You know, you should know what your compliance obligations are as far as they're concerned. And so it's really important to recognize that. Okay. Reps and warranties used to be that you had a real simple kind of comply with all HIPAA rules. Now, as a result of the enforcement climate and just all of the different obligations that also got added on as a result of the HITECH Act, you see much more robust HIPAA security and compliance representations and warranties that really go sort of chapter and verse through obligations under the rule. You also see representations and warranties about not having any type of privacy or security breaches, and not having to make any kind of voluntary disclosures or, breach notifications with respect to any kind of breach. Okay. Let's move on to our last substantive topic. So, pretty much every healthcare provider and supplier diligence project, right, at some point is also looking at whether or not the organization itself has an appropriate regulatory compliance program in place. There is, in fact, except for skilled nursing facilities, I'll put that aside for a second, there is, in fact, no federal law that legally requires an organization to have a compliance program in place. However, it has become standard operating procedure for any kind of healthcare provider or supplier. And one of the reasons it has, it's because there's particularly with respect to False Claims Act cases, in the U.S. federal sentencing guidelines for organizations, there has been for a very long time essentially a mitigation structure where federal judges are allowed to mitigate sentencing for organizations if an organization can show that they have an effective ethics compliance program in place. And there are what's called the seven elements of an effective program. Now, the OIG, DHHS OIG, has published voluntary compliance guidance for pretty much every kind of healthcare provider and supplier that builds on the federal sentencing guidelines guidance and sort of explains to different types of home health hospitals, nursing homes, DME providers, whatever, how they expect or what they would suggest those kinds of providers do in terms of implementing a compliance program. Now, I did say that the law does not require anyone to implement a program except for skilled nursing facilities. So in the Affordable Care Act, there actually was a legal requirement, a statutory requirement passed that requires skilled nursing facilities to implement a compliance program requirements, and those follow the U.S. federal sentencing guidelines essentially. Now, for all other providers and suppliers, what it did, which was kind of bizarre, is it basically said that at some point in time, CMS and OIG shall implement requirements for compliance programs for all kinds of providers and suppliers, but it gave no absolute kind of by this date. So it was sort of a useless piece of the statute, but it is there. Now, why do you want to see this in a healthcare provider and supplier? Because you want to see that they're good corporate citizens. If they're doing this, if they're following a structure of having a compliance officer and having a compliance hotline and having policies and procedures that encourage compliance, regulatory compliance, and having education for staff that encourages regulatory compliance, all that kind of stuff, you generally have the sense that it's you're getting a measure of the culture of compliance at the organization. And so you really do always want to see this in place, and it's usually a diligence item, even though, again, it's not something that we could say that this particular statute requires. By the way, I'm also going to put aside the fact that in New York State, for Medicaid providers, there actually is a legal requirement to have a compliance program in place. With that said, why don't you talk quickly, Cynthia, about some diligence requests on these issues?
Yeah, sure. Right. So as far as looking at diligence related to compliance programs, you'd want to see whether or not the company has any kind of established compliance committee and officer covering the last few years, who that officer is, if there's been any changes, any kind of documents that relate to regulatory compliance policies, procedures, or training materials that the company has internally and provides to their employees, as well as documents that relate to corporate compliance, tracking, assessment, and response in the case where they do come upon the issues. And then if there is a compliance committee, then you might also want to request any meeting minutes from such committee.
A lot of the times what you find from requesting these kinds of documents is, one, maybe the company's not doing any of this kind of stuff. And two, the company looks great that they are doing this kind of stuff. Or three, that something was identified within their program and they didn't do anything about it. And it's something you want to know about. So with respect to reps and warranties on this issue, it's really simple. I mean, you basically are going to look for a rep that the seller has an effective compliance program that either meets OIG guidance or the federal sentencing guidelines or both. And often you find out that they don't want to rep to this because they really don't have that kind of program in place. And from a lender perspective, you often have a covenant that you expect them to put it in place within a certain period of time, just to make sure that they're a good actor. So substantively, those are kind of the major risks and the major ways to deal with the risks that we wanted to talk to you about throughout this webinar. And I really appreciate everybody spending the time with us today. And we're going to open it up to questions in 1 second. I'm going to jump back to our CLE code for anyone who needs it, 10212. Again, 10212 if you need the CLE code. And now I'm going to open it up to questions. We have, should be, I think, on the right-hand side of the webinar box online. You should be able to ask questions. Cynthia and I would be quite happy to take any of your questions to the extent you have them. There are questions we'll answer them. If not, I'll just show you quickly the schedule of the next few webinars that we're going to have in the series. So we'll give it a minute or two to see if there are questions. It's always that first question that takes forever to start up with. And then all of a sudden, everybody has a question. Well, I'll add a little substance to the conversation while we have a minute or two here before we jump to talking a little bit about the rest of the webinar series. I wouldn't necessarily call it a major risk, but it's certainly something to add into transactions as you're doing them in the next 6 months plus, which is just a look at how the target or the borrower has taken advantage of any sort of federal relief with respect to the pandemic. There's a lot of money that has come out of, essentially granted money, that has come out of HHS to providers and suppliers in different ways. And there is also money that is now just trickling from U.S. Treasury to the states and from the states, in some respects, directly to providers and suppliers. With slightly different terms and conditions on different issues, and you really do want to get a sense of how the seller slash borrower, depending on who you are, has gotten that money, if they've applied for the money, how are they using it, how is it going to translate into a transaction, and just whether or not there's any reps or warranty in needed. Certainly to the extent that the money is being kept by a seller or borrower and they understand that they believe that they've kept it appropriately, you want a rep and warranty that they've complied with all the law and the terms and conditions associated with those grants. And to the extent that you, the money goes forward, same thing, you want it essentially on their watch. They've complied with everything needed to comply with on their watch. That's just sort of an extra piece of something that you want to be concerned with right now as these monies are out there. And the same thing goes, by the way, with respect to the Medicare advanced payments and Medicare accelerated payments, to the extent that somebody from a provider supplier perspective has taken advantage of those. There's a new payment structure that's out there now. CMS has come out and said that they can be paid back over time a lot, and that they've stretched out the payments a lot longer than what is available. That was available, and so you want to make sure that you're appropriately dealing for that, both in diligence and in reps and warranties. Barring the fact that I've gotten no questions, which is okay, Cynthia and I have gotten no questions, it happens, we're fine with that. I want to show you quickly kind of where we're going with the webinar series. So our next session is going to be on life sciences and FDA diligence. It will be similar to this session, just talking about the big issues in life sciences and food and drug law diligence. After that, we're going to look specifically at fraud and abuse issues in healthcare services transactions. Then we're going to do fraud and abuse issues in life sciences transactions. After that, we're going to talk specifically about licensure and provider number, change of ownership, and structuring issues in healthcare services transactions. Then we're going to do a deep dive into reps and warranties and the transaction documents in healthcare and life sciences transactions. Then our next program is antitrust. We may have some other programs sprinkled into these, but these are the ones that we have scheduled right now. We would love to have everyone who can join us for any of these programs. Really appreciate you joining Cynthia and I today. Feel free to be in touch with either one of us about anything if you've got questions. I think that's going to wrap us up. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, everyone.